If you want to, if you don't have them, just get them on the website, coasttocoastam.com. East of the Rockies, west of the Rockies, the wild card lines, they're all right there at coasttocoastam.com, and then we'll give you the numbers coming up again at the bottom of the hour. What we're talking about here is power, and how do you get it? What are you willing to do to get it? And what happens to you if you don't get it? And that is one thing we haven't really gotten to. What happens to you if you don't have power? You trade off not to have it. Okay, so does that mean you live happily ever after? Let's take the life expectancy off it. We were talking about that earlier. And for that matter, even whether you'll be just as happy without money. What will define your life in a life without power? And your questions and comments next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Ponet. Before we get back to my questions, let's get in some of yours on Coast to Coast. Dr. Jeffrey Pfeffer, author of Power. Freddie is in Los Angeles, west of the Rockies on Coast to Coast. Freddie?
Yeah, good morning, Ian. Good morning, Professor. My question, I actually have two quick questions. My first question is, what do these people that have power, what are their personality traits? What personality traits
Oh,
do
that's great.
they have in common?
That's a
And
great
then
question.
my second question is, I work in the entertainment business on the set, and you read about the people that made it to the top. Their stories are legendary, how they worked their way up to the mailroom, and they did a lot of backstabbing and manipulation. And Ian said that if someone that's willing to do anything is may lack moral values, but at the same time, like philosophers like Nietzsche and Darwin said, survival of the fittest and will to power, if that's what drives you, is that so wrong? You know what I mean? And I just wanted both of your guys'
Thought on that.
input on that.
Go ahead.
I'll take my answer off here.
All right, thank you, Freddie. Go ahead, Doctor. Let's do the last one first, because you do have a lot to say about kind of that idea of business Darwinism or social Darwinism.
Well, I think Freddie's question was a very good one. And I think his reference to Mailroom, which is actually the title of a fabulous book, which is now quite old, but it still tells, I think, the stories of how some of these legendary figures, including David Geffen and whatever, worked their way up, and what they did to get where they are is like amazing. It is truly an amazing story. And yes, in a world in which I think we, and it's interesting, there's an article in the New York Times that asked the question, how many valedictorians does it take to be number one? We are now raising a generation of kids where the competition has been mostly eliminated. In many schools, they have more than one valedictorian. In some places, they've done away with the idea of a valedictorian. I have a former student who told me that when she was on the swim team, if eight people swam, eight people got ribbons. So students, I think, are living in this idea that they live in a non-hierarchical world, and everybody is like everybody's friend on Facebook or whatever. And then they hit the world, and the world of organizations is a place where there is only one CEO, and there's only one school superintendent, and there's only going to be one governor of California, and there only is one at the moment, one president, et cetera. And so I think we've actually done a pretty lousy job of training the young generation of kids to be ready for a competitive world. And I think there is an element of Darwinism and survival of the fittest, and who's the meanest, toughest person. And you can go back to our history as a, the Westerns, the idea of who was the fastest draw, and who was this and who was that. And I think the ability to tolerate conflict, the ability to not necessarily need everybody liking you all the time, is clearly, to answer Freddie's first question, is clearly one of the requirements to be powerful. If you want people to love you all the time and never want to upset anybody, you probably aren't going to have very much power.
I think that you break down the seven characteristics that are most frequently applied to people of power. And I think I went seven for seven, which was weird because I'm not a powerful guy. But
Well,
it
yeah,
te but I
that just means you could be, but you have chosen not to.
well, I think that, and I said, I think your explanation earlier that there's a difference, you make a choice between autonomy and power. And I really do, I choose autonomy. I've had opportunities to go for more power, and I thought actually I was putting myself in a place where I would have less control over my life, and I don't like that. So, but I was sort of surprised. I was sort of going through, and I was waiting for some of those defining characteristics that would make me go, "Oh, see, I can't do this." But I was sort of stunned by, like, no, I could do that. And that's embarrassing to me. In a way, it's sort of weird. But there are characteristics that are consistent with the most common, successful, powerful people. You want to run those real quick?
Well, I could run down a few of them. I think the most thing, which has been in the background of much of our conversation, is drive or ambition. I mean, you know, if you're going to pay the price and you're going to work as hard as it's going to require you to be successful, you have to want it really badly. And I think that's something we've talked about, you know, and implied in the fact that some people opt out. If you're going to be powerful, you have to have a lot of energy and physical endurance. The energy is like any emotion, is contagious. If you want people around you to work hard, you have to be working hard yourself. You have to be able to show up. And I don't know anybody, ranging from Rudy Crew, the school superintendent of Miami-Dade County, and prior to that, New York, to successful political figures, to successful CEOs, who don't have enormous amounts of physical, just sheer kinetic energy. Another quality is focus. My dear friend Gary Loveman of Harris Entertainment, when he does management training sometimes, he will say, you know, you'll ask people to name the Ten Commandments. And, you know, he says, you know, some of you have seen the movie, some few of you have read the book. But he said the point is that, you know, that most people will only remember the ones that they're currently being challenged with. 10 is a large number. 5 is easier. It's hard to get people to focus on, you know, 10 or 15 or 20 things. And so if you want to be successful, you need to focus. And I think that's another characteristic that brings power, the ability to project confidence. I think the phrase is fake it till you make it. And now actually there's a study with that as a title, which, because it turns out to be actually empirically true, that if you act like you know what you're doing, other people will oftentimes assume you do. And, you know, you can get quite a ways down the road with that. So those would be some of the qualities. Okay. There are a couple, three others, but I think that's a good start.
You know, what's interesting about that is I have a friend who I consider to be, you know, and this is not a high bar, so, but I have a friend who I consider to be extremely talented, much more talented than I am. And more talented than I could ever hope to be. I mean, he's sort of naturally talented in all these wonderful ways. But he's largely broke. He struggles. And I keep telling him, if he had the ambition in his body that I have in my little finger, he would own. I mean, it would be huge. But he just doesn't. That ambition piece, I think, is really important. And I'm glad you let it off as being one of the most important characteristics. Now, that having been said, can you name the Ten Commandments?
No.
Yeah, thank you. Let me get to Kelvin in Michigan on Coast to Coast for Dr. Jeffrey Pfeffer. The book is Power.
Yes. Good morning from Michigan. Nice to meet you, Jeffrey. Nice to meet you, Ian.
Yes.
I spend most of my time researching sort of the NWO deal and sort of the new age paradigm shift. David Wilcock, let's just say he got me started.
You mean the New World Order paradigm?
Yes, yes.
Okay,
yes.
I just want to make sure we understand. Okay.
Yeah, and I would also, I would like to bring up sort of economic and sort of political power plays that are going on right now, because some things that I noticed that at the end of October in 2009, Citigroup was filing for Chapter 11 bankruptcy, I do believe.
I don't know what that is. Explain that real quick.
Well, it's a major banking institution offers credit, and it is one of the house of cards, as they like to put it. And it was filing for bankruptcy. And it went up. The U.S. government picked it back up. But then in June 2009 till this point, I noticed that the market completely stabilized, and it doesn't go above 11,000 or below 10,000 unless someone, particularly in a political position, says something very shaky, very disrupting to the system.
Hmm.
Now,
a question out of that for Dr. Pfeffer?
Yes. My question comes to this. Now, recently, Barack Obama's political cabinet has been sort of cleared out a little bit. you know, we hear it in the news and everything. And I hear that one was Rahm Emanuel, and I do believe the other is the chief economic advisor. I can't remember his name.
Larry Summers.
Larry Summers, yes. And I have a feeling that there is a coin flip going on right now because I can see it. I work at a regular old restaurant, and it says sort of a pancake revolution. You see it sort of in the conscious push. Okay? Okay. You get the idea started.
All right. And the question is?
Now, Jeffrey, do you think that there is sort of a power coin flip going on right now, sort of between the Democrats and Republicans? And I say this because there is a gold bubble and there is a treasury bond bubble going on at this point, and corporations have stockpiled money. Now, okay. They don't know which bet to put it under.
Let's get an answer to that. Kelvin, go ahead. Dr. Pfeffer?
I don't know. I mean, I'm not an expert in gold. I'm not a finance professor, so I'm not an expert in gold bubbles. My friends tell me that there is a treasury bond bubble, but they've been saying that for a long time. So this is a question that is outside my scope of expertise. I have no idea what's going on in politics. I try not to follow it that closely, though I do have some friends who are politicians. So I don't know if there's a coin flip going on or not.
You know, I think that, I don't know whether there can be or whether we can answer that, but there is a larger question about the shift of power that, you know, everybody, this is how I understand things from when I was studying this in chaplaincy, that everybody is in a power relationship, one form or another. And at some point when things get distressed, when there's enough, you know, shift of this power, that's when things can break. What do you think is happening? If knowing what you know about power, is there anything that we can learn from people who are leaving the White House right now at this time, you know, 6 weeks before the midterm elections? Is there anything about that that's indicative of a power shift or the exercise of power by Barack Obama?
No, I don't think so. I think that's a, you know, everybody, there's this myth that, you know, being in government is like an easy job. But to everybody who I've known, and I've known a few people, including Ed Lazier, who was the George Bush's chair of his Council of Economic Advisors and is a colleague of mine at Stanford, everybody I know who's worked in government, and particularly at very senior levels, will tell you how completely demanding it is that you, and particularly under times of economic stress and crisis like this, that you have basically no time for yourself, no time for your family, no time to take care of yourself or anything else. And so it's not surprising that after a while people get burnt out and want to go back to living a, you know, more normal life. So I don't, you know, so if you look at the ebbs and flows of people coming in and out of government, this seems to be pretty typical. After a couple of years, people say, I've had all the fun I can stand. I think I'll go back and, you know, have a more normal and regular life.
And maybe to some degree, cash in on what they've done.
Absolutely. But also, you know, just get out and go.
Well, no, I understand that. But I just mean,
and go, you know, and go have time to spend with their friends and their family.
Well, there's a lot of ways you can make a lot more money doing a lot fewer hours. You know, you can go back to academia, you go to a nice couple of board positions, and you got a cushier vacation schedule. Carl is in Milwaukee on a wild card line for Dr. Jeffrey Pfeffer, author of Power, Why Some People Have It and Others Don't. Carl?
Good morning, gentlemen. It's obvious that power can be a very practical tool. And the discussion has been power at work, power in business. And my question is for the average guy or gal in a day-to-day scenario. Let's say I'd like to have a better seat. Suppose I want to be first in line. Suppose I want to be the really cool guy at a dinner party. Are there things that an average person can do to be perceived as having more power?
Lie. Go ahead. What's your answer, Dr. Pfeffer?
Absolutely. One of the chapters in this book talks about acting and speaking with power, and I have a guy who runs the San Francisco Playhouse come to the class and try to teach students, you know, how to project, you know, more power in their posture. I mean, many people shrink in. They kind of curve in on themselves. They don't stand up straight. They don't project themselves. They don't speak with authority. They don't act like they know what they're doing. And so, therefore, nobody else acts like you know what you're doing. It's really interesting to just, you know, there's a, again, it refers to something I talked about earlier. This is Bill Moyers' documentary on David Rockefeller from many, many years ago. And Rockefeller's arriving at a meeting of the world, the World Monetary Fund or something, International Monetary Fund. And he's walking in with one of his aides. And, you know, and even David Rockefeller was at the time chairman of Chase Bank, says, sometimes you have to move with authority. And that is, I think, exactly right. So it's kind of, you know, do you act like you expect people to defer to you? Do you act like you know what you're doing? Do you speak and act with authority? So, yes, there are some things that you can do in everyday interactions to convey and signal power. Absolutely.
Well, and I think, and Carl, you'll find this chapter of the book very interesting. In fact, his question anticipates the tease I put up earlier in the hour, and that is the trade-offs that one makes by not trying to be powerful is that you can end up being totally marginalized. That if you don't make claims, if you don't, you know, try to establish yourself within the community, you may be the first in line to become a victim. And I think that too, you send a message of power, you send even just that kind of body language, and it can affect a change in your life, even in a very, small version of the concentric circles that surround us all.
Yep, and let me say one other thing. There's just been some research that's come out, which is consistent with this idea that if you act like you are powerful, it actually changes physiologically some of your blood chemistry. So you actually, you know, it actually changes you in some physiological way. So if you act one way, it will change your blood chemistry in ways that will make you feel consistent with how you're acting.
Very good. I did find an article which explained the comment I'd made in our first hour together. And that's that the personality disorders manifested in people who are considered psychotics, a mixture of charm, manipulation, intimidation, and occasionally violence to control others in order to satisfy their own selfish needs, fit the same profile as politicians.
And probably CEOs, too.
The FBI leads the world in research effort to develop a series of assessment tools, and this is one of the things they've come down to, that serial killers and politicians share most of the same traits. Let's go to Nate, who's in Point Arena, California, on Coast to Coast for Dr. Jeffrey Pfeffer. Nate?
Hi, good morning, everybody. Ian, I just want to say you have some really great perspectives, and I dig it.
Good. Glad to have you. Thank you.
Yeah, back when I did have job control, I have to say that was really good and non-stressful, so I agree with that point. But back to the CEOs, I just want to ask if most of our companies that have shareholders and that are necessarily on the stock market, are they corrupted by this kind of, or would you say most of them are corrupted by this kind of power and manipulation in order to have these returns for their shareholders and kind of what you talked about with Enron?
Ian, do you want to answer that?
No, I think that you're much better qualified for
that. Okay, fine. Well, you're the one who mentioned the Enron thing. No, yeah. I think most people, you know, I think Enron and WorldCom and some of these others were really extreme cases. I think, you know, if you look at their 5,000, I think, companies in the Russell Index or whatever, I would say most people are trying to do a good job. And most people are fundamentally trying to, you know, live as they believe other people want them to live and as they're expected to live. So I would say most organizations are run in a pretty decent fashion. And the problem, frankly, is not so much the organizations. The problem is we live in a country where we measure our economic success by GDP growth and by the level of the stock market, and not by people's well-being. How many people are employed? Are they making enough money? And, you know, what is their health status? So if we changed our criteria for evaluating organizations, maybe the organizations would change what they do.
Are you a Batman fan at all, Dr. Pfeffer?
Not much.
Okay, well, just for future reference, I got an email from a friend who said that the mastermind criminal Two-Face is a great example of this. Half of him is the attorney general, the district attorney, rather. The other half of him is a criminal. And that if it's true about politicians and serial killers, he's the perfect example of that. Maybe not as big a conflict internally as we had thought. Dr. Jeffrey Pfeffer takes more of your calls on power coming up next on Coast to Coast. Power, about the traits of the powerful, the need to have it, why you should want power, and at the same time, why you should be suspicious of the power that's over you. Mentioned that earlier with Jeffrey Pfeffer, and he kind of took exception to the idea of suspicious. But then I went back and I said, where did I get that idea? And I went back into the book and I had underlined this part on the cover. Power, he argues, is a force that can be used and harnessed not only for individual gain, but also for the benefit of organizations and society. Power is not something that can be learned from those in charge. Their advice often puts a rosy spin on their ascent and focuses on what should on what should have worked rather than what actually did. That's the cause of my suspicion. You know, people are always blowing smoke up our nose. We'll get to what you know coming up next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. West of the Rockies, Dave is in Washington State on Coast to Coast for Dr. Jeffrey Pfeffer. The book is Power. Hello. Dave?
Hi there, Ian. Dr. Pfeffer. An anecdotal observation. A couple of years ago, I was at one of the conferences that's held of the world's top 100 CEOs, and I was just part of the hired help there, but I had a chance to observe people. And I noticed this. The Asians were the least self-possessed, the most likely to acknowledge your existence and seem to be, you know, pretty casual. The Europeans seem to be the healthiest and happiest looking, and the Americans, by far, seem to be the most narcissistic, egotistical, and phony of the group. And I understand the compensation ratios of Asian CEOs are, you know, way lower than they are for Americans versus the average worker at the companies that they control. And I wonder, you know, has anybody ever made some of these observations, the differences in the behavior patterns, the personalities of these people, and how these incredibly high compensation levels seem to affect the personality?
Right. Yeah, it's really interesting.
Absolutely. I think that's a very shrewd observation. There are enormous cultural differences, not just because of the compensation levels, but the Asian societies are much more collectivistic, and there is much less emphasis on the individuals separate from the group. Your identity in the Asian cultures tends to be much more your identity as part of a group, and so you're not going to try to profit at the expense of your fellow group members, or for that matter, at the expense of the welfare of the whole, quite nearly or not nearly as much as you would in some of the Western cultures. So yes, there are enormous cultural differences in how people relate to each other, and you've picked up, I think, very astutely on that.
The servant leadership model amongst CEOs in this country was a movement that was popular for a while and seems to have stalled. And yet I liked a lot of things about it. I think a lot of CEOs found it kind of constrictive, how much money they could give themselves, you know, pledging to stay within certain ratios of what the lowest paid person was making on the factory floor, that kind of thing. Where do you stand with servant leader people of power?
Well, I think it's a great thing. I mean, you know, if you worry about making the organization successful, one of the things that's been a subtext of our discussion is, you know, are you interested in creating an organization that serves its customers, that takes care of its employees, and the two, of course, are related, and that is built to last, to use the Collins and Porras book phrase? Are you interested in just, you know, making yourself successful and getting as much as you can as quickly as you can? And you can see both kinds of behavior in the world, and certainly you can see both kinds of behavior for both politicians and corporate leaders. And power is really about your individual success. And that may sound a little selfish and self-centered, but one of the things I would point out to your listeners, if they haven't been reading the newspapers very carefully, is that organizations really don't take care of you. They will throw you out and lay you off, and I'm not talking about for bad performance, but I'm talking about for any kind of economic exigency. Partners, if you look at law firms or accounting firms or venture capital firms that are run as partnerships, very often partners get thrown out. There was an article recently in the New York Times about Goldman Sachs, about how nice it is to become a Goldman partner, but it's even nicer if you're able to stay a Goldman partner. So right. Just because your colleagues are calling you partner doesn't mean that they're looking out for you and your interests. So you have to take care of yourself. It's a theme that I think we need to kind of teach people and remind people of on occasion that you are responsible not only for your own power and your own success, but you have to take care of yourself and don't look to the organizations to be, you know, just very beneficent because they're not.
You know, I've said this in a different context, but I maintain it's true that all systems are inherently dehumanizing. That any time you enter into a system, you are dehumanized to a point. It doesn't mean that you're just a number, just, you know, but if you needed money and I gave you money, then you and I would be in a relationship and there would be, it would be a human, one human being to another. But as soon as you've got an organization that receives the money and then turns around and distributes it to other people, everybody becomes commodified on both ends of the deal. And that kind of commodification, I think, is dehumanizing. And we don't think of it that way, but I think we ought to accept that, that it's just as true within a company, that we as soon as you join something that big, you know, to some degree, we accept a level of being dehumanized by the system. Not that there's another way around that, but it just goes to show you in the smaller the circle, the greater humanity you'll very likely have. First time caller line, Randy is in Brooklyn on Coast to Coast for Dr. Jeffrey Pfeffer. The book is Power. Randy?
Hi, guys. It's great to talk to you, Ian. I'm a big fan.
You're nice. Thank you very much. Appreciate that.
Well, I guess I had a question for the guest and then just a quick observation. I wanted to know if the guest is familiar with the book, The 48 Laws of Power. And, you know, any thoughts that he might have about that book. And then also I wanted to just kind of, you know, bring up, it's kind of interesting. I think, you know, free will, if people are so easily able to, you know, project their image onto others, what does that say about free will?
That's a good point.
Well, on the 48 Laws of Power, I think it's an interesting, it's a very interesting book, but it goes back to my comment about the Ten Commandments. I think 48 is too large a number for most people to keep in their head. So what I've tried to do in this book and what I try to do in my teaching is to give people a relatively small set of principles that they can use in a variety of different situations. You don't have to remember a bunch of unrelated things, but it's certainly an interesting book, and it is, I think, modeled very much on Machiavelli's The Prince, which is still, I think, a great source of insight on power. And sure. And for the second question, or for the second part of your question or observation, I think it suggests that the people are not as independent as we oftentimes think they are. And, you know, we could have a metaphysical or philosophical discussion about free will, but if you actually look at social psychology and sociology, we are, all of us, I think, constrained by and part and parcel of and influenced by other people with whom we are in contact or with whom we are in relationship. Yeah. So the idea that we are autonomous actors is not, I don't think, is really often the case.
I agree, and a good point, too, on that, the idea about the Ten Commandments. You think about 613 laws of Orthodox Judaism, and most people struggle to even remember the top 10. Yeah. that even that is, it's more, so 48 would seemingly be a hard thing to index in one's brain. Wildcard line, Dave is in Riverside, California, on Coast to Coast, for Dr. Jeffrey Pfeffer. Dave?
Hi. It seems like most of tonight's interview has revolved around the negative of the expression of power, borderline despotic behavior that is tantamount to tyranny, from family circles all the way up to the larger, more influential world affecting groups that you've paid a lot of attention to tonight. And I'm wondering how this can be ultimately justified in the scrutiny of, let's say, the creator, God's court of penance, or whatever metaphysical or religious concepts have not entered into the fray here tonight. Most of this discussion, as I've observed for years now, as I said, tantamount to the negative polarity of the expression of power in contrast to, let's say, the open book of nature and all of the other aspects of that actually allow us to be ongoing as conscious beings created from somewhere. The source, of course, has been discussed for and investigated for centuries. So it's the negative polarity that I see emphasized here tonight.
What would you, Dave? Just so I understand, because you're being so negative. So tell me, what was it? What would you prefer that we had addressed? I don't think I understand your point. What's missing in this?
What's missing is the discussion of the actual aspect of purity, of honor, of honesty, where the power is inherent in that kind of behavior, where there is a level of altruism, of compassion, of consistency.
Well, let's have Dr. Pfeffer address that. So he's saying, where are the the bon mots here for all of the people of power who are altruistic and have a great amount of integrity and honesty?
Well, I would respond in two ways. First of all, power can be used, obviously, for accomplishing major social change and social good. So, I have a friend who's mentioned in the book, who I was a former student of mine, Laura Esterman, who's done amazing things to at the Carol Frank Buck Breast Cancer Center, or Breast Care Center at the University of California in San Francisco, to change the design and operation of that center to provide compassionate care to the women who are suffering this dread disease. And she's also done some amazing things to change research and the gathering of data to hopefully cut the cycle time for learning about cancer and cancer treatments, again, as a way of making things better. But in order to do this, she, of course, had to also develop her power skills, because UC San Francisco is, to put it mildly, a very political place. So, yes, you can use power for good or for evil. Power is kind of like a tool. You can take a saw and you can make a beautiful piece of furniture, or you can attack your neighbor with it. And what I'm trying to teach people to do is to understand, if you will, the sociology and the social psychology of power. I'm not an ethicist or a moral philosopher, don't have any particular expertise in that. And, I would ask people to kind of get training or grounding in those disciplines as a figure idea. So my job is to teach them about the tool, and then it's other people's job, or it's their own job through their own kind of moral philosophy and upbringing to figure out how they want to use it.
To a point you just made, in to amplify it a little bit, a couple months ago I was allowed to be around a very powerful CEO of a not-for-profit with deep international reaches, somewhere in the area of $4 billion worth of goods and services that it provides to the underprivileged, does an amazing job in countries at the request of the U.S. government to go in and help people, just phenomenal work. And he was an absolute control freak. The CEO was bordered on abusive, the way he would berate people at the head of a very large altruistic organization. And I don't think they ever would have grown to be as big as they were if he wasn't such a brutal taskmaster. But it surprised me to be around him, see him doing that, and so openly, and how he was belittling people around him. And I thought, wow, that's not what I would have thought from an organization that has such a warm and fuzzy international reputation. Bill is in Tokyo, though, and I want to get to him here on Coast to Coast for Jeffrey Pfeffer. The book is Power. Bill?
Yeah, hi, good evening. Am I on now?
Yes, you are. Go ahead.
I'm in the situation where I bet you a lot of maybe listeners who work for large corporations have sometimes experience where you've got a change of management or takeover merger. And then the new people on the job throw their power around. You get micromanaged, you get pushed around, you start to lose your power. And how do you deal with those managers, or do you take the clients and run? And is there a time frame that you suggest, give it a couple months before you leave? Or do you say, hey, I'm going to take the clients and run, so let's play ball nicely, right?
Dr. Pfeffer?
Well, I think that's it's a wonderful question. One of the mistakes I think people make is that they believe that, it is their responsibility to make bad situations good and to give people in power over them a chance to kind of reform or come to see the error of their ways. And oftentimes, it goes back to this thing that we just talked about, which is you need to take care of yourself. So if you find and it's really kind of ironic or sad, and this happens in the public sector and the private sector. New CEOs come in, new leadership comes in, and the first thing they do is they change whatever is there. Even if they change some of the things that weren't working, they change some of the stuff that was working. They just change, because they want to put, in quotes, their stamp on it.
Right.
And certainly if you are part of the organization that has been taken over, the victors are going to tend to lord it over you in a variety of different ways. So, if you find the situation uncomfortable or difficult, and if you've got some leverage to move clients with you, I think you ought to take care of yourself and not wait for people to come to see the error of their ways, because you may be waiting a long time.
I got to ask you, what was that paradigm? I'm trying to recall it off the top of my head. It's not the sky high paradigm or the heaven is just paradigm, or
the just world paradigm.
A just world paradigm. That if you think that it's a just world and you operate on the standpoint that the good will succeed and the bad will be eventually punished, chances are you'll lose.
Well, and I mean, who knows? I mean, every religion talks about the account settling in some subsequent iteration, the afterlife, heaven or hell, reincarnation, whatever. But certainly on this plane, you cannot count on the beneficence of your organization or even of senior managers. You really need to become self-reliant and take care of yourself. And the more powerful you become, ironically, or maybe not ironically, the more powerful you become, the more other people will like you and want to be around you and will help you out. So it goes back to something, Ian, something that you talked about earlier, that we create our own realities. And
right.
It's really up to us to create the realities in which we want to live.
And make your own luck, in a way. By
absolutely,
doing
absolutely.
Elaine, Fort Myers, California, on Coast to Coast. Elaine?
Hi, good morning.
Hi.
My question is what is your take integrity in the high-profile religious figures like the Pope? I mean, it's a business, ultimately, and what is your take on the integrity and power of these individuals?
Of religious leaders, not-for-profit leaders in that way?
It is all the same, and I think your comment about it's all a business is exactly correct. I think universities are very much businesses these days. Nonprofit organizations, which of course have to take in more money than they spend out, there's been political struggles. The Red Cross for a while went through a bunch of different leaders. Organizations are organizations, and there's just as much politics in most religious organizations or nonprofits as there is in the for-profit sector. So you need to kind of get used to it and get ready for it.
I'm going to try and squeeze in Bob, east of the Rockies. He's in Nodak on Coast to Coast. Hey, Bob.
Hey, how you guys doing?
You got to be real quick.
I just kind of want to reflect a little bit of what the other caller kind of stole my glory there. But, I just heard a lot of the negativity here tonight about how to rise to power and between the lying and the cheating. And it just makes it sound like that's the only way to get to the top. And, absolute power corrupts absolutely. And I believe in honesty's best policy, and I just would hope that this professor would be teaching his students that there's another way to get to power, and that is the honest way. Because
okay, well, hold on. So go ahead, Dr. Pfeffer. Respond.
I try to teach my students to the best current knowledge about interpersonal dynamics and how to. On how the world works, and I try to in my teaching counteract the leadership literature, which I think produces or kind of portrays often a very overly rosy picture of how the world works. We need to get people ready for the world in which they're going to live.
And so there you go. Back to the just world paradigm, which you say will that'll kneecap you, right? You will, or handicap you, maybe. Dr. Jeffrey Pfeffer, Power, Why Some People Have It, Others Don't. I hope you had a good time. I did.
Thank you so much. It was really a good time.
Well, you're very interesting, and if people disagree with it, gosh, go to the source material, grab the book, figure out where he's wrong, take a look from there. Deus te amat, and I do too.